Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 2:37 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time, excuse me, Summer Time, and today is June 23rd, and of course being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And I think it is really the biotech sector which has really stolen the show in here this week. It has experienced quite an emphatic breakout. It's been up on consecutive days, and today there was a little bit less in terms of the clear breakout or the momentum behind it, but this is a very emphatic upper dynamic following what has been a very inert environment for much of the last 6 months. And we can see from the chart that there has been a progression of higher reaction lows since the middle of last year. The most important thing, and I've reiterated this in numerous audios, is that it had an enormous advance between 2011 and 2015, and it didn't give the whole thing up. It pulled back significantly, but it spent all of last year ranging, spent most of this year ranging at somewhat higher levels, and now we're getting an upside breakout. This was also the week in which the US Senate released their healthcare plan, and it would appear to be, I think the most important thing about it is that it made no mention of drug pricing, and that's part of the reason that not only the biotech sector, but the healthcare sector generally was in positive territory this week. But and that is also breaking up out of a two-year range. This is a return to form for the healthcare sector. Now, there are some worries about I guess there are some worries from the consumer's perspective about just how much premiums are likely to come down, and that it is going to result in a number of people losing Medicare. But the question that investors would have been asking was whether hospitals or drug companies were making money off Medicare in the first place. And probably rather than try to parse through everything that has been said about healthcare in the last week, we should simply rely on the chart patterns. And what the chart patterns are telling us is that there is a clear upward bias here, that these lengthy periods of consolidation are probably over, and that the biotech sector is coming off of what was a significant corrective phase and is returning to a position of dominance. Of course, this also represents really quite a useful teaching example from the perspective of what we talk about at the chart seminar. We define ranges as explosions waiting to happen, and that also means that when a breakout occurs, it tends to occur faster than people have been largely used to, because the range is generally boring relative to the trending phase, that we get used to this very inert environment. And then when things change, it can be surprising. And that is then, of course, when something is already, for example, just looking at the index in front of us, the healthcare sector index, when it is 800 odd points higher than the trend mean, people will obviously look at it and say, well, golly, I can't possibly buy it now. It's already broken out. It's gone too far. So those are the people that will be waiting for a pullback. They also represent a potential source of demand during a pullback to ensure that pullbacks aren't too severe. But then, of course, there will be other people who look at a breakout and say, well, I have to buy that, this is momentum driven. I am a momentum trader, so I'm going to buy this. And then, of course, what they are hoping is that the momentum will persist. And, of course, they are taking an additional risk, because if the breakout does not hold, then it could quickly fall back below their entry point. So there are risks to both strategies, but the most important thing is that we would give the benefit of the doubt to the upside as long as it is holding above the region of the trend mean. And this is a clear breakout. And if we then also look at how we talk about failed upside breaks, what does a failed upside break tell us? It tells us that the vacuum of supply above the market has not formed. that the reason that a breakout occurs is because of a vacuum of supply forms above the market. And when the price moves into that vacuum, it punctures the vacuum and prices get sucked higher. And that's what happens. The prices will keep rising until they encounter a balancing offer. And if that does not occur, what it tells us is that the vacuum of supply has not formed. And if the vacuum of supply has not formed, well, then what will happen is that people who want to short the stock will proliferate and you'll get a failed upside break, which would be characterized by a clear downward dynamic. And it would, in this case, require a move back below 900 in a pretty swift manner to question the intensity of this breakout. And in the absence of that, we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Would it have been better to buy last week or 2 weeks ago? Absolutely. But that's unfortunately that is that was 2 weeks ago, and the breakout has happened this week. The reason I'm addressing these points is because I've had an email to expressing I think almost dismay at the fact that the market is moving so quickly right now. Of course, it isn't just healthcare. Healthcare isn't the only market in the world, but it is an important one. And when we think about what the, and I think there is an additional point. For example, I think we can start to draw a thread between a number of different points. For example, the VIX index is back to 10. This is an incredibly inert environment, despite the fact that we are getting a heightened condition of single stock volatility. The aggregate volatility is quite low, and that is something that I think is largely computer driven. So, if we start to think about passive investments and computer programs and how do they size their positions, then there are a number of trading strategies that they will be using. But an important characteristic is that with passive strategies, they're investing in ETFs, and potentially how they hedge the volatility in an ETF is to short volatility. So by buying the index, they're shorting the volatility, or it's something to that regard, that there is a two-step process. By investing in equities, you can hedge out your vega. And that is potentially what is contributing to this very low volatility environment. And if that's indeed the case, then when we look at, for example, large ETFs, and I'm simply taking the biotech ETF as an example, but I think the most important thing about it is that it has a market cap in excess of 9 billion. When passive investment strategies that will be moving into a rotation into biotech, they'll be buying the big ones, and then the fund will have to go out and buy the big ones. So it'll be the what I've pointed out on numerous occasions over the, particularly since Christmas, is that the immuno-oncology sector has been leading on the upside. That it really does represent the cutting edge of technological innovation within the biotechnology sector, because it is where the really where personalized medicine is being forged, because cancer is such a difficult disease to cure, because every one of them is different. Every one of them has got a different genetic makeup that it requires an almost completely individualized treatment plan to tackle every one of them. And that's a completely different business model to what the pharmaceutical sector historically has had to deal with. That the primary goal of pharmaceuticals has been to identify a broad spectrum problem and then produce a drug that treats it for lots and lots of people. That you can have a very widespread problem, you produce one drug, and it tackles that one disease in every single person. But that's just not how cancer works. It requires a great deal of personalization. That also contributes to why the cost of cancer care is so expensive. But what we are seeing now is because of big data, because of CRISPR gene editing technology, and because of decades of research, that we're getting an increasing number of treatments coming to market that have commercial utility. And that is a really, that's an incredibly important period for this sector. That there were a lot of promises made back in the 1990s about what we could expect from personalized medicine and from the future of biotechnology. And it's taken almost 20 years, but they are now beginning to be realized. And that is a powerfully bullish factor. So that's what we're seeing now. We're seeing the biotechnology sector moving back to a position of outperformance. And if we are indeed getting a rotation, then it is going to represent some money flowing into the sector, which is obviously feeding through into some of the very large cap shares. So, for example, Gilead Sciences is one of the very large cap shares that had pulled back really very sharply. It almost halved in the last 2 years, but it is one of the top three holdings within the Nasdaq Biotech Index. So that has, if we are going to see passive flows moving in, then just by weight of money, that could help to reverse what has been an incredibly persistent downtrend for 2 years already. Then, when we look at, for example, Celgene, which is the second largest share on the index, it is breaking up. It is at least going up there to test the 2015 highs and was really firm this week. And Amgen is the largest share on the index, and it is also right up there testing the upper side of what in this case is a more than 2 year range. But I think it is the immuno-oncology sector is the one that is really quite likely to lead, and it has been leading. And Kite Pharmaceuticals is another one of these small companies that just broke upwards today. That it is up already, well, it was up over $11 on a $100 share just in the last 2 days. So that is, I think, the hard edge of what is happening in the technology sector at present. It is then worth highlighting it against the Nasdaq 100, where that index is dominated by some extraordinarily large mega cap technology shares. But it is still really quite overextended. It's about 600, well, I guess less than 600 points overextended relative to the trend mean. But it has, and it did have a rather big pullback 2 weeks ago. But there hasn't been any additional downside follow through. And in fact, it has been firming over the balance of this week. It is probably going to spend some time below this psychological 6,000 level. And I think that the most likely scenario is that we are into a period of ranging consolidation. That major shares like Amazon, which bought Whole Food Markets this week, have been pausing around these big psychological levels. Like 1,000 is an area where at least some people will be conditioned to pause and to think about what next. And Google is also trading around this 1,000 level. It pulled back by about $60, but it is now recouped the majority of that decline. But the broader point is that it's at $1,000, so it is a natural area where we can anticipate some pause and consolidation. Apple is still the largest share in the world, and it did pull back really quite sharply. It has held around this 140 area this week. And that has unwound about half of its overbought condition relative to the trend mean. So I think the most likely scenario is that we are getting mean reversion, and that the mean reversion is going to be So far, at least, it has been relatively smooth, that it has given way to ranging consolidations, and that clear downward dynamics, like we saw earlier this month, would be required to signal that we're going to get a swifter process of mean reversion. But if we're thinking about what is going to outperform, well, then these shares have already done spectacularly well. If one is looking for catch-up potential or a rotation, then it's likely to be in other sectors. And I think that, that there's still a great deal of momentum in shares like Tesla, and it was up again in here this week, having broken out of this short-term range. I think, we do have to look at the longer-term chart to get some scale that it has almost doubled this year. That it was at just about $200 in the last week of December, and it's at 383 right now. It started ranging when they started building the gigafactory ba or the giga battery factory, and it stopped ranging when they completed it. And this has been an absolutely emphatic advance, but it is massively overextended. So there is certainly the risk that we could, even if we go back and look at 2013, there were two swingeing pullbacks in the course of the latter bit of 2013 and early 2014, and that is just not beyond the bounds of possibility on this occasion either. That this has been an incredibly emphatic breakout. It was a very large range, and ranges are explosions waiting to happen. So we have had an incredibly impressive advance. It has continued to go up faster and more than most people were expecting, which is often the definition of a breakout, but it will eventually pull back. And because it is a very volatile share, then that pullback could be quite severe. So I think that that also will contribute to a rotation coming up, going on within the sector. Nvidia was in mildly negative territory today, but it has done spectacularly well, moving from 100 to 160 in little more than a month. But that was a very large downside key reversal 2 weeks ago. And now, having got back up to the 160 level, it is pulling back. I think that the most likely scenario is that we are going to have some pause and consolidation at least. And that would suggest that if some money is coming out of some of these really overextended shares, then where does it go? That people will still be looking for bull markets, and then it has to go somewhere. And the S&P 500 has been very quiet. It's gone pretty much nowhere since the beginning of this month, and that's positive, because what that is doing is unwinding the overbought condition relative to the trend mean in a very orderly manner. It has been an incredibly consistent advance since the beginning of 2016, and if we just go back and look at that on the daily chart, we can see that there are a series of ranges one above another, and that as long as it is holding above 2400, I don't think anyone is going to be worried about the S&P 500. When we If, and because Wall Street broke up and out of these very long-term ranges 3 years ago, one of the reasons that I spend so much time talking about Wall Street is because it has been the clear leader. That and there is a difference between leadership and relative strength. Leadership is a temporal designation. It's about timing, and leaders tend to to lead for a reason. And the S&P 500, the Nasdaq, the U.S. market generally has been leading because the Fed was most aggressive first with its quantitative easing. It was most aggressive in forcing the banks to write down, to sort out their balance sheets, to write down debt, and then made a great deal of capital available to them to sort out their business models, because they were so aggressive. That contributed to asset price inflation and allowed the stock market to break on the upside in 2012. Well, if we look at all of Europe, not just the Eurozone, the SXXP is the Eurostoxx 600, then the index got up to test the upper side of this long-term range back at the beginning of 2015, but it has taken until now to recover that big pullback. So it hasn't quite done it yet, but it is looking increasingly likely that that level around 400 isn't going to hold forever. Now we have got all the way back up to it, and there is some consolidation going on right now, but it is looking increasingly likely that because the ECB is printing money as if it was going out of fashion and already has its balance sheet up to 4 trillion, that is going to contribute to the same kind of asset price inflation in Europe that we've already had in the USA. So it is looking increasingly likely that Europe will succeed in breaking on the upside. The FTSE 100 has already broken on the upside. It's now trading at 7,424, even though it was down a little bit in here today. The most important thing it's done is break successfully above that 7,000 level. And as long as it is holding that 7,000 level, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. This is the resolution of a 17-year bull market, excuse me, bear market. And when that occurs, then generally speaking, we kind of have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But if 17 years sounds like a long time, well, then we should really be looking at Asia. Taiwan hit an important peak back in 1990. It's spent much of the last 27 years ranging below 10,000, and it broke upwards in the last couple of weeks. So it is being led higher by by TSMC, Taiwan Semiconductor, and also by Hon Hai Precision, which is Foxconn. So that represents two big stories. If we think about TSMC and Nvidia, then we can also start to think about why. Why are these chip manufacturers doing so well? Well, the answer is clear. There is going to be demand for a lot more processors. And car companies really are under pressure to deliver more. That if the cost of owning a car is approximately $8,000 a year, and you don't drive that much, then the cost of using an Uber is less in many cases than $8,000. That means that car companies have got to come up with a better rationale for owning a vehicle. They either have to have more added extras or they have to drive themselves, and that is exactly what they're doing. So they are investing in battery technology, and they're investing in more added extras. They're investing in connected cars, and that means that there are going to be computers moving into just about every new car, and that is going to require a lot more chips. If we're going to have autonomous vehicles, then they're going to need powerful chips, and there isn't quite the same price point when one is talking about a vehicle that costs tens of thousands of dollars relative to a gaming PC, which could cost anything from $500 to $2,000. So, or indeed more than that, depending on how much spec one wants. That is helping to drive a significant bull market in these chip manufacturers. And in addition to that, because Ethereum mining is, well, it's possible to make money from Ethereum mining in the cryptocurrency space using graphics cards. So Russia is selling out of them because so many people are trying to mine Ethereum. It isn't quite the same thing with Bitcoin because they use a different architecture, which is largely dominated by Chinese manufacturers, which produce these ASIC machines. That is also creating quite a significant demand growth driver. So there are a significant number of demand growth drivers for chips, but not necessarily for desktops. So that is that there's a quite a clear delineation there. Then, if we look at what the second largest share in Taiwan is, it's Hon Hai Precision, and that's the biggest manufacturer in the world. They employ upwards of a million people in China, and they're one of the largest innovators in robotics technology because they want to replace as many of them as possible, and they are talking about opening a factory in China. Well, what I find particularly interesting, excuse me, talking about opening a factory in the USA, what I find particularly interesting is that people seem to anticipate that that's going to create a lot of employment. But that factory, wherever it is built, is going to be largely automated. They are going to be investing in nearshoring because they think they can do it at a competitive price. And because energy prices are low in the USA, and because there is a really quite clear consumer-led economy, then one of the largest costs, both in terms of money and time, is transportation. On the radio this morning, I heard that that for companies with less than 23 employees, the minimum wage is going up to $10.20 on the 1st of July, and that for companies with more than that, the minimum wage will be going up to I think it is $12.70 in Los Angeles, and minimum wages are going to $15 by 2020. So that's important because there is a serious incentive if you have 20 employees to invest in automation rather than paying all of them an extra $2 an hour if you hire three more people. There is a huge incentive now for smaller companies to invest in automation. This is largely a tipping point because minimum wages are going up so quickly that it is going to have an effect on quite a significant number of smaller businesses. And that is something that is going to also feed through into this push and pull between automation and then being automated out of your job. So these are really quite significant challenges, but it's likely to be a massive value creator for companies because these companies will be benefiting from the pace of automation. So that is something that is really quite a profound change. I think what I find particularly interesting is that it is major tech CEOs that have been responsible for some incredible disruption have been among the most vociferous in promoting universal basic income. Not least because they believe that that is what the majority of people would like to hear. But if we had universal basic income, that would probably be one of the most inflationary outcomes that one could possibly hope for or fear. Because if you start giving money away to people, then it isn't as if you're increasing the supply of goods and services. It is simply that those goods and services will, the price will rise back, or will rise enough so that the same level of consumption continues. And that is the very definition of inflation. So then we are at a rather critical point in time. There is a great deal of outstanding debt. US 10-year treasuries are at a rather pivotal point. They've been holding here around 2.10, 2.1%. It's the region of the trend mean. There is a really quite significant message in this contraction in yields so far this year. The bond market just does not believe that the Fed is going to be able to raise interest rates. And they are really quite wary of the attempt that the Fed seems intent on doing of reducing the size of the balance sheet, even modestly. The Fed's balance sheet is around 4 trillion right now, and it is very unlikely that they envisage ever bringing it back below 2.5 trillion. And I've seen arguments saying that that any kind of scaling back in the size of the balance sheet could be very modest indeed. And part of the reason for that is because with the massive increase in the supply of dollars, investors have become largely addicted, and that dollar funding demand has increased substantially, not just within the US but internationally. So there is a massive demand for dollars out there, and shrinking the size of the balance sheet represents a significant challenge. But it leaves open the big question. If the Fed is raising interest rates, they are attempting to reload the interest rate gun. This expansion has been going on for a significant period already, and they're beginning to worry about what will they do when we have the next recession. And that's a significant question. It's over $700 billion needs to be refinanced next year. It's over $950 billion the year after, and $950 billion the year after that. And what I think a lot of people who are not particularly familiar with the bond markets, they tend to look at the quantity of debt and say, "Oh, this is an enormous problem." But usually, the debt servicing isn't nearly as large a problem as the debt refinancing. Because usually companies and borrowers can service the debt. They can pay the coupons. But when it comes to refinancing, that's when you have big questions being asked, because it is either going to be a case of investors don't want to refinance the debt, and if they are willing, at what interest rate are they willing to do it at? And that potentially represents a significant additional cost for all lenders. And the US Treasury is a significant lender, despite the fact that it is another arm of the government is buying the debt, that the servicing that debt, paying the coupons to the Fed, represents a significant draw on the public purse. And issuing debt at 1.5% in 2016 is not the same thing as issuing debt at 2.4% in 2017. The fact that the bond market is it just has no credence in the Fed's prognostications that it is going to continue to be able to raise interest rates, that suggests that they are betting on a deflationary outcome. And this is a very important point, because if we do have deflation, technological innovation is inherently deflationary. The pace of technological innovation is happening at such a rapid rate. Amazon's acquisition of Whole Food Markets represents a significant experiment. They're going to fiddle around with how to run Whole Food Markets. They're going to try and figure out how to make it work. But one thing that Amazon has been doing is that it has been cutting the delivery times. And with food, it's got to be same day. 10 years ago, 5 years ago, it was within the week. Now with Prime, you have 2-day shipping. If you want to pay a little bit extra, you can get shipping on the same day. And with food, you usually get it within a couple of hours. That requires a massive logistics operation, and Amazon has been one of the companies most aggressive in building out these data centers, but also building out these massive warehouses. By acquiring 450 food outlets from Whole Food Markets, then it is also buying its infrastructure. If we take a step back and we start to think about what does the future hold, then because minimum wages are rising, and it isn't just Los Angeles, it's an increasing number of large population cities in the US are raising their minimum wages up into the teens. That's a significant cost for large companies. And when we start to look at some of the major retailers that are also major employers, well, Macy's, for example, went from 70 and it's currently at 22. Then if we look at, for example, Target is another major retailer, and it really did pull back sharply when Amazon decided to buy Whole Foods. Kroger is another example. And even Costco, which is one of Charlie Munger's favorites, pulled back really very sharply, and it is now trading back below the trend mean. This has been 2 significant weeks on the downside for a share that has gone from 40 to 180 in the last 8 years. It isn't just in the food sector or the general goods sector, but TJ Maxx is rolling over. That increasingly looks like a completed type three top. Ross Stores, which I would define as being on the lower end of the mass clothing retail market, has had an even bigger pullback. Now, the broader point, of course, is that all of these are massive employers. That the retail sector in the USA is employs upwards of 12 million people. And these are publicly traded companies. If they get significant drawdowns, they're going to start cutting their headcount. They are going to push for more automation. And that means that while it is certainly benefiting some of the companies that are developing this technology and are moving online, that the companies that do not rise to the challenge of are the and I can give you a very good example. When my wife decided to start up her jewelry and fashion design company, she went around and looked at warehouses, and she went around and looked at retail locations, and came to the very striking conclusion that they were practically impossible to make money from, that rents were too high and footfall was too low, and that the lesson that is very clear from the street is that the mom and pop shop no longer exists. So she decided to simply go with Amazon and sell on Amazon Prime. She opened an eBay store and sells on eBay, and she's waiting on permissions from Walmart to sell her products on Walmart. And it is interesting that Walmart is investing very heavily in its online offering. So it might have pulled back sharply this week, but it has been going in the other direction relative to some of the other big box retailers. And that would suggest that their investment in by buying Jet, by investing really quite considerable sums in their online offering, that is perhaps one of the things that will stand to them. And I think that that is the way the market is moving. That rather than employing all these salespeople, rather than buying or really renting or committing to leases, to be more accurate, of these very expensive retail locations where, in fact, nobody's going anymore, then the cost of setting up a business online is going down. That by And simply then a question of whether you can compete on price or you can compete on quality. And if you can compete on both, well, then you are in a pretty solid position. So that would suggest that we are getting a massive rotation, and that is going to have a quite a significant effect on employment. So employment right now is almost full, the way that the Fed is measuring it. But that is a really big question, because a lot of those kinds of jobs have been part-time. And in what sectors do part-time work proliferate? Well, it is mostly in retail and in restaurants. And retail is in severe trouble. So when we look at the bond markets and we see these yields contracting, then and the bond market is saying that there's going to be a deflationary outcome. Well, they could be right in the short term. There could be a deflationary outcome. And just if whether those yields find support in the region of the trend mean or extend their move below it, then that is going to be a very large question. The US 30-year future broke on the upside this week, and it is trading back above 155. It has not done so in a particularly dynamic manner, but 155 represents the region of the trend mean, and it is now trading back above the trend mean. Prices pulled back very sharply following the election in November, on the expectation that there was going to be a big fiscal bump. But what the price is telling us now is that bond investors, at least, are less willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the US administration. So that is having a knock-on effect, and bond prices are rising. And I think we are going to require a clear downward dynamic. We're going to require clear evidence of an inflationary bias to shake the complacency of bond bulls, and for them to really conclude that we are not going to have a deflationary outcome. And part of the reason that people are also concluding that is because oil prices have been pulling back so very quickly, that prices were at $55 in towards the end of May, and they're closer to $45 right now. And because oil, regardless of the fact that we are getting massive improvements in the pace of technological innovation that is contributing to battery technology and solar and wind and geothermal, the reality is that the global economy is still highly reliant on fossil fuels and transport, most particularly on oil. And there is plenty of oil. We went through a decade of massive investment in additional supply, and that additional supply is now coming online. There was a great deal of hedging activity going on around January, and that means that there is a significant quantity of oil that has been brought to market that can be sold at above $55 a barrel, regardless of the fact that the spot price is at 45. And this has been a very consistent decline. There is still a rivetingly consistent progression of lower rally highs and a clear upward dynamic similar to what we've seen at previous lows, but particularly in May, in December, in November, in September, and August. Those are the kinds of upward dynamics that would be required to check what is a bearish environment over the short term. It's been my belief for a number of years that the closest analog that we could have for oil is natural gas, that we could be in for a very volatile environment, and that the what will proliferate is a generally weaker price environment with some substantial trough to peak swings, and then the occasional spike on either weather or geopolitical events, but that we have been through a period of time where we've had a lot of oil investment, and that investment is now giving through, paying off with a lot more supply. And that's not particularly inflationary. What that does is it removes headwind from growth. That is actually contributing to growth improving, but not in an inflationary manner. It simply removes a cost. So the reality as we are presented with is that this is still a benign environment for stock markets, that it is unlikely the Fed is going to be raising interest rates aggressively, and that they have got a window between now and sometime in 2018 that of raising interest rates. But After that, there is a great deal of debt needs to be refinanced. And that also means that it's in their interests to have low interest rates, because refinancing all of that debt at attractive levels would offset a great deal of worry among a lot of borrowers. Now, the big question is whether they can pull it all off. That really is a massive question, because nobody has ever done this before. And that really is, I think, the big unknown out there in the market. Nobody really knows how all of this debt is going to be worked out. What we do know, though, is that the yield curve has contracted from approximately, and I'm going to create this spread, it's contracted from approximately 300 basis points to, I think it's about 80 the last time I looked. And the most important thing about it is that it is going down. So the yield curve has been a reliable lead indicator for recessions for much of the last 50 years. Right now, it's at 80 basis points exactly. And when we look at that with a bit more back history, we can see that it doesn't generally go below zero particularly often. But when it does go below zero, that's an inverted yield curve. And it has been trending lower for a couple of years already. It's only 80 basis points above an inverted level. But even when it becomes inverted, we have a lead indicator of between 6 and 18 months for the next recession. So we're in the middle of June right now, and or towards the end of June right now. And let's say that if the pace of this decline persists, then it may become inverted at some point next year. Well, then that would suggest that the next recession could be in 2019. That's important, because when we go back and we look at some of these stock market indices, we do have to ask ourselves an important question, and it is there any evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend-ending characteristics? And the answer is no. We have not had a loss of momentum. We have not really had acceleration. These have been pretty orderly advances. And until we have evidence of type 1, type 2, or type 3 trend endings, we have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And that doesn't mean that this, what is a secular bull market, won't be punctuated on occasion by the odd recession. The most important thing to remember, though, is that those will set up wonderful buying opportunities. And the fact that we're seeing an increasing number of emerging markets breaking up out of significant ranges is really quite encouraging. That India spent upwards of 3 years ranging and broke out a few months ago and has continued to advance. South Korea experienced a large downside key reversal in 2011, and that held the market up for the next 6 years, but it has just broken out. And these represent some of the markets that benefit most from low energy prices and low commodity prices generally. What I find of particular interest is that Australia and Canada seem to have really quite a similar condition in terms of their stock market composition. They are both dominated by the banks and the materials sector. The ASX 200 has paused below 6,000. If, though, we look at the longer term chart, it had a significant peak in 2007 following what had been really quite an impressive accelerating market, and it has labored below that level since. It really does need to hold the region of the trend mean right now to if the benefit of the doubt is to be given to the upside. And if we look at the weightings of the index, then one of the things that really stood out about some of the most indebted countries before the financial crisis was the size of their banking sectors. For example, the Irish banking sector constituted 80% of the index in 2007, and it was only this week that Allied Irish Bank was listed once more at a fraction of its previous value. And if we look at the Canadian composition, then we get a similar story. That it is the financials represent an almost identical weighting within the Canadian index, and then that is followed by both energy and materials, so that it is actually a much more concentrated market. But it's also something that is pausing below a big psychological level. It's right in the region of the trend mean, and certainly the banking sector has been given something of a reprieve by Donald, excuse me, by Warren Buffett bailing out Home Capital. But the reality is that this is a market that is very heavily influenced by both oil and access to credit. And they were able to they skirted the credit crisis because commodity prices were going up, and that there was a because China instituted a massive stimulus. But it's less likely that China is going to rescue the commodity sector on this occasion. They're much more dependent now on what happens in India, and that India will be looking for lower commodity prices to engage in its own economic development, and that infrastructure development is likely to be slower than China's. The continuous commodity index broke lower in the last couple of weeks. This is an unweighted index, and that this represents a significant deterioration. That it still looked like it was a consolidation in March when it was testing the region of the moving average, but this no longer looks like a consolidation. It looks like a quite significant deterioration. It's obviously being led lower by oil, but then if we look at, for example, coffee, excuse me, that's not typing particularly effectively. Coffee prices have been pulling back in a rather accelerated manner recently, and only began to show signs of picking up in here today. That 110 level is a previous area of support, and prices have bounced from the 100 level on a series of occasions over the last decade. Sugar prices are pulling back really very sharply, and there's no great deal of evidence just yet that the decline has found support. And against that background, it is the London Metals Index, which has been really quite steady and was actually up this week. It has an analogue in the copper price, and copper prices have continued to firm, and this area around $2.50 has continued to represent support. But then we look at, for example, zinc. Well, there is, and I think that there is a solid argument now for looking at commodities on their individual merits. But the fact that industrial metals are really exhibiting relative strength in this environment, that suggests continued faith in global economic expansion. And perhaps with less inflation than central banks are anticipating. And I think that's a really important point, that there is this is still a bull market environment. What we have evidence of is some rotation within the stock market, but that it is still a benign environment, that there are growing risks out there, but that they are medium-term risks. They're not pressing risks. There is the potential for geopolitical events to move front and center potentially over this summer, but so far that's all it is. It's just potential, and that is something that we will have to deal with as situations evolve. But I think I've probably gone on for long enough, and I wish you all a peaceful and restful weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.